Vice Chair Outlaws, this is our kickoff event for the Outlaws and National Warriors Guild. This is our kickoff event for the semester. It's Mr. Coleman. We are very lucky to have him here, actually. He's an advocate and an expert in gay rights, single rights, and family diversity. And he's going to speak to us and lead a spirited discussion, which I think we probably would have with us in here, about gay rights and family diversity and single rights. He went to, what is the name of the college? Because I've been trying to do research at the colleges you went to here at Wayne.
At Wayne, I went to Monteith College, which no longer exists.
Right. And he got his JD from Loyola in Los Angeles, has done tons of work with governmental agencies, has done represented test cases here in Michigan, and has testified in front of Michigan legislature. So with no further ado, Mr. Thomas Coleman.
Thank you.
Take it away, sir.
Thank you. So now we'll roll up our sleeves, and for those who have sleeves, like me, and I'd like you to feel free at any time to, it's a small group, that we can, you know, have a conversation about the things, the issues that I'm going to be talking about. So if at any point you have a question or a comment or something like that, you know, feel free to chime in, you know, and if I'm in the middle of a sentence, you might wait till I finish, you know, my sentence or something like that. But I have a handout that I prepared that you can share with others. It's posted on the book's website as well. And it, you know, it talks about the issues that I'm going to talk about today in a slightly different way. I want to talk about it verbally with you more from an action-oriented point of view. And the topic is the future of gay rights, singles rights, and family diversity in Michigan. Now, I just published a book called The Domino Effect, which looks back over the last four decades of what I've done since starting law school in these areas around the country, including in Michigan. And while the book is a documentation of history of what's happened, it also talks about where we are right now and projects into the future. So what I want to do is to focus today on where we are, maybe a little bit about where we've come from, but mostly where we are and then where we can be in the future, and particularly in Michigan. So I'm going to try and make it as relevant as possible to this state. And I'm very interested in Michigan because I was raised in Michigan. I was raised in Ferndale. I lived in Detroit. I've got family in Michigan. I've got friends in Michigan. And so I still, my heart still is in Michigan. You know, I'm a Californian, you know, now by spirit, and I'm glad I moved when I did, despite the earthquakes and everything. But, you know, there's a lot of work to do here. In preparing for today, when I took a look at the state of affairs, legally and politically in Michigan, it was like, oh my God, what you're facing is this monumental task. But then I switched, you know, pivot. Okay, let's not look at the negative part of it. You know, that may be for a moment we can focus on that to, you know, kind of adjust to reality, but we have the power to change things. And what the book documents is that one person or a small group of people can make huge changes in society. If there's a real strong vision, if there are goals, if the process is inclusive and inviting, if coalitions are built around various issues, so much can happen. And I think that the same is true for Michigan. And so basically, I want to follow a little bit the principles that I outline on page 4 of this handout, which I think underlie creative change that's going to be effective change. The first is the process starts by acknowledging the truth. Know the facts and know the law. Acknowledging the truth can be very powerful. You know, it can really transform things. Just that moment of acknowledging the truth can just change the dynamics of a situation. I'll give you an example. I was before the Supreme Court of California. And of course, standing up in front of seven justices that are about to, like, rip you apart or potentially rip you apart can be very intimidating. I was waiting for the case to be called, hoping that it would be the last case and not the first case. And it turned out that it was the morning session, it was the first case, and I was the first attorney to be called. And I'm like, oh, my heart is pounding, I'm nervous. I thought, God, oh my God, what am I going to do? And so I thought, you know what, acknowledge the truth. So I got up there and I said, you know, introduced myself and said, Your Honors, I've got to admit, I am very nervous. I said, it's been 18 years since I've been before this court. And the Chief Justice smiled and he said, well, Mr. Coleman, don't worry, nothing has changed. And everyone laughed. The audience laughed. Of course, you've got all the lawyers, all the clients, and all these cases sitting there. You know, this is a huge audience. When you're the last case, there's almost nobody there. So I said, well, that's terrific, because I won that case. Well, everyone laughed again. Then he stopped for a second, scratched his head, and he said, maybe some things have changed. And everyone laughed again. And the tension was broken. It became more free-flowing. I forgot about my nervousness by just being human, lightening up, you know, and all of that. Turned out, I did win that case. And it wasn't a gay rights case or a sexual orientation case, but it was a securities fraud case. And the law was changed in California as a result of that case. And the last principle that I have here is think outside of the box. Be creative, be proactive. How I got to the Supreme Court with that case also is an example of thinking outside of the box. I had had a case a few years before in the Court of Appeal where they shot down all my arguments in a published decision on the same issue. Then I got assigned another case as a court-appointed attorney. I was in the Court of Appeal with the same case, and I knew that the Supreme Court had just taken a case with those same issues. It was Charles Keating case. It was a guy that had ripped off a bunch of people and so on. So I thought, oh man, I mean, the lawyers in that case are going to shape this issue, that case will be decided, I'm stuck with whatever turns out in that case. And I thought, if I could only get my case to the Supreme Court and jump ahead of the other case, you know, what are the chances? Well, then I started reading the rules. And it was like, oh, the Supreme Court does have the power to yank a case from the Court of Appeal and bypass the Court of Appeal and to, you know, to take the case. So I thought, okay. I petitioned the court to do that, said, here's all the wonderful arguments you're going to get, gave them a little synopsis of it, and they took it. And they put me as the lead case. So then Keating had to wait for this case to be decided. So it was like, if I had been thinking it couldn't be done, or if I didn't look deeper for some possibility or have that feeling of, you know, wouldn't it be nice if this could be done, you know, and maybe it can, and I'm going to try and make it happen. It really happened. So, you know, think outside of the box. Be creative. I want to give a couple more examples of that before I get into Michigan, because I think really the key here is for all of you and anyone who's interested in these issues in Michigan to be creative, to be persistent, to look for the opening, wherever it is. There's always an opening somewhere. It may not be the legislature, it may not be the courts, it may be with the executive branch, at least for that particular 2 or 3 years. Then what can you do with the executive branch for that 2 or 3 years? One of the examples I give about thinking outside of the box has to do with my marriage to my partner in 1981. You know, we fell in love, and we wanted to get married, and we were going to have a ceremony, and then it's like, well, where are we going to have it? What are we going to do? Where are we going to have it? And I thought, from a legal point of view, I'm thinking, there's no nation on the planet that recognizes same-sex marriage. Where are we going to have it? Where are we going to have it? Kept thinking and thinking, and finally it's like, aha, I've got it. So we developed a poster of a big ship being towed by a little tugboat, and it said, recognized by no nation, married in international waters. We removed ourselves from the jurisdiction of all nations and exercised our basic human right to enter into contracts. And we never tested the legality of that, but we took 300 people out beyond the three-mile limit for about 10 minutes so we could, you know, exchange the vows. Of course, everyone's hanging on as it's all getting rough out there. But it was thinking outside the box. It's like, no nation on the planet. Well, is that going to stop us? Heck no. We're going to do, you know, what is inherent in our right as people. Because, you know, historically, marriage wasn't performed by the priest. The priest was a witness. The people performed the marriage. So, you know, that's what we did. Now, another example that I want to give you, a couple quick examples. One, the Supreme Court of the United States took a case. I became co-counsel on it. And this was People versus Uplinger. This was back in the 80s. And we were afraid they were going to reach through this case to go back to a decision that the New York Court of Appeals had made, where they had declared the sodomy law in New York unconstitutional in violation of the federal constitution. You know, we had wished they would have insulated their decision by relying on the state constitution, but oh no, they had to like put it right out there, the federal constitution. Well, the Supreme Court never took that case, although some of the conservatives wanted to take it, but they didn't have enough votes. It takes four votes to take a case in the Supreme Court. So, but in this case, the Uplinger case, the result was based on the Onofre case. So therefore, if they decided the Uplinger case, they could reach into it and say that was an incorrect decision, the right of privacy does not protect consenting adults in the privacy of their home. And I remember going to talk at that time to a guy by the name of David Goodstein. He was the publisher of The Advocate magazine. And he said, well, you just have to get the Supreme Court to dump the case and not to make a decision. I thought, yeah, right, they just took the case, and we're going to tell them to dump it and not make a decision. So I was very skeptical. And then I talked to another lawyer friend, more seasoned, activist. Larry Sperber had been involved with the ACLU for many years. And we talked about it, and it's like, aha, cert improvidently granted. We are going to argue that they made a mistake because this new case was based on state law, not on federal law. And sure enough, a 5-4 decision where they dismissed the case, cert improvidently granted, and, you know, New York stayed in the sexual privacy rights camp. So again, you know, think outside the box. Look for openings. Yes? Not too often. Now, in this case, you know, it takes four justices to grant cert, so you got to have five to dump it. And apparently, we had the five, you know. But of course, then a few years later came the Georgia sodomy case, and they, you know, just slammed us with that. But at least we postponed it for a while. The final example I want to give you does pertain to Michigan. And at some point, I want to talk about this in depth, either later or we can stay in communication, you know, in the future about this. But way back in 1981, 82, the California Privacy Commission issued a report. I was the executive director of it, and included a lot of gay and lesbian issues as well as a lot of issues dealing with privacy rights for many different types of constituencies: people with disabilities, seniors, unmarried couples, etc. And one of the things that we recommended was that the state of California should have some type of a registry. We didn't call it domestic partnership because at the time the media was trivializing that when San Francisco passed a domestic partner law. The mayor, Feinstein, vetoed it. But the media was calling it the live-in lover law and people were snickering. So we thought, let's call it a registry for alternate families. Since our Supreme Court had just ruled that people who were not related by blood, marriage, or adoption under our Constitution had a constitutional right to live together in areas zoned for single-family use. And they had called those families alternate families. So we said, let's pick up that language and then suggest that there should be some type of a registry, because if the state is going to grant benefits or impose obligations on alternate families, you have to identify them. Otherwise, administrators won't be able to administer a system unless there's some way of identifying. Well, one of the first things should be done is the family itself should declare itself to be a family. And who is in the immediate family? And then the state should have a place where you can register. And then the legislature can decide piecemeal to put different, we called it the hub of the wheel, to put spokes into that wheel. You'll have this right or this right or this obligation and so on. But you've got to start with some way of identifying. So for years went by, there was nothing. Then around 1990, it still kept bugging me. There's got to be a way. There's got to be a way. And I got up one night, middle of the night, and I thought, oh, I think I've got it. I think I've got it. And I was working out of my house. I had a law library in the house. I went down to the library. I started looking. I said, Secretary of State. What came to me was Secretary of State. There's some mechanism that already exists in law. I don't know what it is, but I know it's there. Why? I don't know. I'm following my intuition. I'm being guided. I don't know. So I looked through and I looked through and I looked through. About 2 hours later, I said, I've got it. I've got it. Oh, my God. I'm so excited. Well, I mean, any rational person would say, you've got to be nuts. It was a law that allowed an unincorporated nonprofit association to register its name and or insignia. It had been used mostly by moose lodges and, you know, different fraternal organizations. But I thought, this is it, because and this is as good as we can get right now. What is a family? A family is an association. What is an association? A group of people with a common purpose. Therefore, a family is an association. A family is not a business. It's not a business venture. It's a nonprofit venture. Therefore, a family is a nonprofit association. A family is not a corporation. It's unincorporated. Bingo! A family is a type of unincorporated nonprofit association. Well, if you registered with the Secretary of State, how would you register? What would you do if you registered your name, let's say? I thought, well, family of Thomas F. Coleman and Michael A. Vasquez. And if everybody who wanted to register their family started out by family of and then listed their members, in this registry that the state has, there would be this huge subsection that would de facto create a family registry. So I thought, okay, we're going to try it. So I filled one out for Michael and me. We filled one out for a lesbian couple, sent it to the Secretary of State's office. A couple weeks later, we get back this gorgeous, ornate certificate with the seal of the state of California on it that said, family of Thomas F. Coleman and Michael A. Vasquez, signed by the Secretary of State of California. I thought, okay, we're onto something here. But I always believed in inclusion and coalition building and broadening base and so on. So I thought, okay, we are going to do this right. So we got a single parent guardianship family, a single man who had become a guardian for three boys from Guatemala. Had him fill it out. We had a unmarried couple without children, heterosexual couple. We had an unmarried couple with children. We had a married couple step family where they had kids from, you know, so I thought, married couple families don't have one certificate where all the immediate family is listed. You got to pull out your marriage certificate and the birth certificates and then connect the dots. So we had a married couple family with two biological children and then two developmentally disabled adult women that were adult foster children in that family. So we had seven families. We sent them all in. A couple weeks later, they all came back rejected. Oh, shit. You know, I thought, what the heck? Well, the first one had just gone to a clerk typist. But when all these other ones came in, they were like, something funny going on here. So they sent it upstairs. And it went to the legal counsel for the Secretary of State. And he couldn't figure out what was going on, so he said, reject them. Well, then I thought, okay, now I've got to, like, call them up or write to them and tell them what's really up. Well, the Secretary of State was Democrat, liberal, Asian-American woman, elderly. He was gay. The legal counsel was gay. So when I told him what we're up to, oh, well, that's a different story. Submit them again. Submit them. We will even give you space in the state building to hold your press conference when you hold it. So then I got a psychologist friend of mine that I had mentioned earlier, Nora, to write a little paper about the psychological benefits of being able to identify and having the state, you know, echo back, yes, you're a family, and having a certificate. And then a union organizer who wrote about the benefits of when you're going to work to try and ask for benefits for your family, to have something in your hand rather than just, you know, asking verbally. They say, look, family, we're family. So I gave the story as an exclusive to the LA Times. Front page of the paper on the morning of the press conference, there it was, the picture of the married couple family with the developmentally disabled women. And then farther on the story, there was a big picture of two men who had been together for 40-some years. And, you know, it was announced. Well, it went through papers across the country. Well, of course, the right wing was furious. Oh, my God. They were like, it bent them out of shape. And then there were attacks, and a legislator introduced a bill to try and redefine association, not to include that, and that wasn't getting anywhere. So then he asked the legislative council for an opinion, and the legislative council said a family can't register under this law, and they sent that to the Secretary of State, and she said, I'm a statewide elected official, I'm the one that decides how to interpret this law, and I'm saying it stands. So then they went to the Attorney General, Dan Lundgren, darling of the religious right. He wrote a published opinion. No, this is illegal. You can't do it. Thank you very much for your opinion, but this is going to continue. So for a while, we had this de facto registry. And the value of it was to announce to the world, socially, politically, legally, family diversity is here. This is the reality of how we live in our society. Everyone isn't a married couple. We need rights, we need benefits, and here's, you know, and we need a mechanism for doing all of this. And so it got that conversation going. Eventually, we got a statewide registry for domestic partners. It's not as broad as this and so on, but it does have real rights and benefits and all of that. So, but the connection with Michigan is that at the time I researched and had another sister, not Carolyn and not Diane that I mentioned earlier, but another one, I said, why don't you submit to the Michigan? It's not Secretary of State here. It was the Michigan Department of Commerce. And so she submitted her name, her husband's name, their biological daughter's name, and her son's name from a previous marriage. And there we have it. And it had the seal of the state on it and all of that. So this procedure exists in Michigan. I checked. The law is still on the books. And I really think that at this time when there's this aspect of stuckness in Michigan, that there needs to be a conversation about family diversity. And the issues and concerns of the gay and lesbian community should be a part of that conversation, not necessarily dominate it, although the opposition always picks one thing out and tries to dominate it. But this could happen. This could, same type of thing. There could, and this is, the director of this department is under the jurisdiction of the governor. So you give them a heads up, say that we want to do this. There's no immediate rights and benefits we're going to get, but it's going to be a way to stir up the system to try and get a conversation going about the need for a registry, the need for benefits, and so on.
Well, I know I interviewed with a judge here in the 36th. Well, actually, the juvenile court last year, and we were talking about adoption, and I brought up a term, alternative families, and she just looked like stunned. She's like, and she said, "I hate to say this, but what is an alternative family? Nobody knows that term." And mm-hmm. I know I'm a part of the alternative families section in the family law part of the ABA. And nobody really understands what alternative families are. And when I explained it to her, she's like, you know what, because we're talking about adoption. She's
yeah.
like, you know, I never really thought about it in that way. I'm like, you all just focus on LGBT families. And it's like, you got singles.
Yeah.
You have elderly. You have disabled individuals. You have
yes.
Ability issues individuals that have different family structures outside of the heterosexual family structure. And you just kind of throw them out the window because you simply don't understand what the concept is. You think family is one thing because that's all you see every day.
Yes. Yeah, and it's very broad. So the a lot of people didn't like the idea of alternative, you know, and so on. So we try to use family diversity, and there are many types of families, diverse types of families. And, you know, and you when you look up at the definition of family in law, it's very flexible. I mean, The origin of the word in Latin is familia, and familia means household, and all of the people under a common head of household. So it's not, the primary definition is not blood marriage adoption. It's not, you know, all of your blood relatives. The primary definition is household based. If you go to Corpus Juris Secundum or one of those treatises, you'll find the primary definition of family is household based. And so I think that is going to be one way, when you consider some of the roadblocks that have been put in our way to try and get benefits for unmarried couples, for same-sex couples, and for alternate families, that we're going to have to maybe temporarily, until we can undo the State Defense of Marriage Act and its erroneous interpretation by the activist Republican Supreme Court, we may have to use different terminology than terminology that kind of mimics marriage. So, but now what I want to do is just for briefly talk about, still under acknowledging the truth, that society has changed a lot since I lived here and moved away. The law has changed very little in Michigan. What's changed a lot in society? Demographics. Now, I mean, it used to be in the 1950s, about 78% of the households were headed by married couples. Today, a majority of households in Michigan are headed by unmarried adults. Married couple families are a minority form of household in this state as of a year ago. Now, the statistics will come out in a few weeks, and we'll see what's up this year. Does it slip back a little? Does it continue to be more unmarried majority? We are living in an unmarried majority nation. The majority of households in the nation are headed by unmarried adults. The other thing that's changed in terms of cohabitation. A majority of people now cohabit prior to marriage. We're talking about heterosexual couples. So the fact that we have this ridiculous anti-cohabitation law on the books in Michigan, it is so out of touch with reality. They're basically stigmatizing half of the heterosexual population that does cohabit as a decision-making process as to whether to stay together, to break up, to continue to cohabit, or to get married. And then in terms of having openly gay and lesbian people, you know, I didn't know any openly gay and lesbian people in college when I was here at Wayne State. There were no gay organizations. There were a few gay bars in the city, but that was about it. Now look, you know, you have gay and lesbian organizations, you have gay people open with their families at work, this and that. It's a more open society. So socially, things have changed. Now what about attitudinally? What about the attitudes of the general public? Attitudes have changed a lot. In 1989, there was a study done by Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance about the definition of family. And what did Americans think was the most appropriate definition of family? And they gave three definitions and said, which do you think is the most appropriate definition? One, people related by blood, marriage, or adoption. Two, people who live together. Three, people who love and care for each other. 72% chose the people who love and care for each other. And that holds true today. People, the society, average people are beyond the blood, marriage, adoption straitjacket. So that attitude has changed. In terms of like domestic partnership benefits, 60% of the public in Michigan supports health benefits in the workplace for same-sex domestic partners. I did some in the paper here. I mentioned that there was a study done at Columbia University where the researchers looked at public opinion polls from 2000 to 2008 and combined them together, and then they had enough of a sample to actually look at what was happening in individual states on certain issues. And in Michigan, what they found was 74% of the public in Michigan feels that sexual orientation should be added to the hate crime statute. 78% believe that sexual orientation discrimination should be outlawed in housing. 64% believe the same in jobs. Now, when you get into civil unions and marriage, it gets a little closer. So 49% said they supported civil unions. 47% said they supported second period adoptions. But those figures are in the process of moving. They're not stagnant. They're going to keep moving in the direction of more and more support. So that's how far we've come, you know, in terms of attitudes and in terms of how we're living. So what has happened with the law? It would still, private sex between consenting adults would still be a felony in this state if it weren't for the U.S. Supreme Court. We tried for years. The legislature wouldn't do it. The Supreme Court wouldn't make that statement. Michigan wouldn't make the statement. Finally, it took the U.S. Supreme Court to do it. So Michigan is being dragged, kicking and screaming into the new millennium. And so then if we look at other areas, what's happened? Well, the voters brought us the Defense of Marriage Act. I really, from what I see, I really don't believe they intended to outlaw domestic partnership benefits, but now we have the Supreme Court in their wisdom saying that. The legislature has not passed any gay rights measures whatsoever. You know, and you compare, in the middle here, I say gays and lesbians are protected by hate crime laws in 32 states, housing laws in 15 states, and employment laws in 20 states. Michigan offers no protection at all. The other thing, the Attorney General slammed second parent adoptions. The good thing is the governor has been a ray of hope, doing a little bit, you know, issuing an executive order protecting, prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination in state employment, and appointed a couple of openly gay judges. I think. I thought Rudy was the one and only, Rudy Serra, but he told me that there is an openly gay judge in Howell, I think, that I wasn't aware of. So, Holland, sorry. So it's you know, and then what the Supreme Court has done has. Again, activist judges trying to impose their conservative agenda, they've created some real problems with respect to even if the legislature adds sexual orientation to the Elliott Larson Act, the Supreme Court has now created a religious exemption to the Elliott Larson Act, and presumably to any local act. They have ruled that someone can hide behind their religious beliefs to gain an exemption from at least marital status, and I presume they will apply the same thing to sexual orientation. This is the Hoffius decision, the fair housing decision, where a majority of the court ruled just the opposite. They said there was no exemption and that unmarried couples were protected. That decision came down December 22nd, 1998. Two justices retired as of January 1 of 1999. Justice Corrigan, a real piece of work, joined the court at that time. She was the one who wrote the lower court decision that was under review. So she should have stepped aside. No. She got involved, and then she talked Justice Taylor into participating, who had recused himself in the original decision because he was on the Court of Appeal in the decision under review. So all of a sudden then, they came down with a majority ruling vacating that portion of the decision that rejected a religious exemption. So now you've got a Supreme Court ruling that basically sets the stage for pretty much the only people that would discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation are ones that would use religion as an excuse, could now claim an exemption. And when the case went back down to the trial judge in Jackson, the trial judge granted an exemption under the Michigan Constitution Free Exercise Clause, and so the landlord won the case. Now, I notice that there's a measure that's going before the voters, I think, in Kalamazoo in this to add sexual orientation, to prohibit it in as an ordinance in employment, housing, and public accommodations. Well, if that passes, that's great. But it's still going to be subject to the possible, you know, discriminators claiming a religious exemption under the Michigan Constitution. So what do you do with that? You know, how are you going to get around that? Well, one way of getting around it is called federal preemption. So this is where I think that the activists and advocates, political people in Michigan need to really get behind the ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act in Congress. Because if Congress, or when Congress, adds sexual orientation to federal non-discrimination law, the state constitution is preempted by a federal statute. You will not be able to, you know, so that will end, you know, that. And the Supreme Court has never, Supreme Court of the United States has never granted a religious exemption to an ordinary individual, not a church itself or an organization, to exempt themselves from a law of general applicability. And I don't think they're going to. So I think that with respect to housing and employment and so on, the way to go is to really put energy behind the federal Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which I think has a reasonably good chance of passing during the first term of President Obama. In terms of other issues, with respect to second parent adoption, I know there's a bill pending now that would try and do it, use generic terms, and not have it mimic like a spousal-like relationship, or not call it domestic partners, but two adults, and not have it be based on an agreement, but more based on mutual willingness to support the child. So I don't know what's going to happen with the Michigan legislature. You know, it seems like there's always, right now, there's a Republican veto in the Senate. So I say that really I think that people in Michigan need to reach out to moderate Republicans if you want to get any progress in the legislature, or replace them with Democrats. But legislative change at this point can be vetoed by the Republican majority in the Senate. So I don't know where that's going to go. Now, with respect to the hate crime law, that's pending in Congress, but it doesn't give full protection. It just allows, I think, the FBI to cooperate with local authorities if there's a hate crime that's based on sexual orientation. You need to really add sexual orientation to the and gender identity to the Michigan hate crime statute, and probably there should be more agreement about that. I know there's still Republican opposition, but I remember in California, I placed my bet on the hate crime statute being the first statute that would have sexual orientation added on a statewide basis. And at that time, we had a Republican governor, George Duke Majan, and he had originally voted for the first hate crime statute that dealt with just, you know, race, religion, national origin. And he was Armenian, so he understood about, you know, genocide and group hate and so on. So we had suggested adding age and disability and sexual orientation. The legislature passed that. And then, you know, with a few reminders and some Republican outreach, he did sign it into law. So I thought that was a good bet, you know, because if we had tried to get him to sign an employment non-discrimination one, it would have been vetoed, or almost anything else would have been vetoed. So you reach to the so-called opposition, or to elements of the opposition, to find out what can we agree on. If we can't agree on freedom from violence, then like it's a lost cause. And so I think that under state law, and you're not going to have a religious exemption to a hate crime statute. No judge, I don't care how reactionary they are, is going to say, oh yes, you can use your religious beliefs to kill this person or whatever because you hate, you know, gay people. So, and then with respect to domestic partnership benefits, especially for, you know, state and local and other government agencies and their employees, I think the way to go at this point, since you're stuck with the Supreme Court decision, is to use different terminology. And I know that a couple of universities have done that. They just said other designees or other designated people. And this reminds me of a case before the Georgia Supreme Court a few years ago. I think it was like 1995. To me, that's a few years ago. And the city of Atlanta had passed two ordinances on domestic partnership, one to create a registry and one to create benefits, for health benefits and other benefits for city employees. And, of course, the reactionary forces came out and filed a lawsuit, and the lower court judge ruled that both ordinances were invalid, and it went before the Georgia Supreme Court. And I thought, I got to get involved in this. And so we got a local union involved to represent, and then my nonprofit organization, and filed a friend of the court brief, and I worked closely with the city attorney's office there. They had a brilliant lesbian city attorney who was spearheading the case, Robin Shahar. And so finally the case came down. The Supreme Court ruled that the registry was valid, but they invalidated the benefits portion because the definition of domestic partnership mirrored, it was like marriage-like relationship or spousal-like relationship. And they said only the state can define, you know, spousal relationships and so on. But there was language in the decision that indicated that if it had been based on a different type of criteria, that the court would have accepted it. So I thought, what would that criteria be? Dependency. The term dependency is used in different state statutes. I looked them up. It was broadly based. It's not based on spouse or anything. And the word dependent would apply even if a person was partially dependent, or if two people were interdependent. Because I thought, you know, most domestic partnership relationships, both people may work, you know, and so it's not, one isn't really an IRS dependent being almost totally supported by the other. There are some relationships like that, but most of them, both people are working, even if one's working part-time, but one of them doesn't have benefits and so on. And so I thought most of these relationships are relationships of financial interdependency, that the couple could not maintain the lifestyle that they're maintaining without both incomes coming into the household. Therefore, they're interdependent. So I said to the city attorney, don't ask for a rehearing. There's a silver lining in this cloud. Let it stand. Amend the law, amend the ordinance to base it on dependency, and let them attack it again, and I predict you're going to win. That's what happened. They won. They've got the benefits. And so that's something in Michigan that I think that could be used, is either a definition of dependency or household-based. That, you know, being able to designate another adult member of your household, and, you know, the question for some employers is to how do you deal with it that you don't just have people moving in for 1 week to get benefits a month before they're going to have a major operation. So you have to deal with the process of what they call adverse selection. But you can have an eligibility, a length of time that you've lived together, or you can say that they have to show evidence of interdependency, that they have mutual wills, or they have, you know, you can do some way to do it. And I think that you could at least start out with the presumption that it doesn't violate the Defense of Marriage Act and it doesn't violate the Supreme Court decision, and then let somebody attack it and let it go through the courts again if that's the way to go. The other way, I think, for domestic partnership benefits is to put another initiative on the ballot to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. But I think, and I first I was thinking maybe there would be two initiatives, but I could see one. I could see one happening where the one clause would say, you know, the whatever it was called here, I'm just calling it the Defense of Marriage Act. The Defense of Marriage Act of 2004 is hereby repealed. Okay, you can't get any clearer than that. Number two, you know, state and local governments and other governmental entities are authorized to extend benefits and protections to domestic partners, and then define domestic partners in a way that it's not limited to same-sex couples. We've got to make this about us in the broader sense, rather than about us in the narrower sense, so that it's more than just, well, we're talking about 3-5% of the population. No, you're talking about a much larger percentage of the population when you're talking about same-sex and opposite-sex couples in the workplace, because when studies have been done, they show that when an employer offers an inclusive, gender-neutral domestic partnership program, about 60-70% of those who sign up are heterosexual couples. So, you know, this would definitely appeal. And then also the concept of domestic partnership appeals to a lot of seniors. When we had bills in the California legislature starting in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and so on, about domestic partnership, registry, domestic partnership benefits, and so on, the seniors groups supported it because many heterosexual seniors were survivors of a spouse dying, and they would lose pension survivor benefits or other benefits if they remarried. And yet they didn't want to be considered strangers in the eyes of the law. They wanted to have some connection with each other. They wanted to have some status in society. And so when the bills were called for a hearing before the legislative committees, it was the senior groups, that the gay groups stood back and said, we'll talk. But they allowed the senior groups to go forward first. And that's the way it always proceeded. It was always intended to be inclusive and gender neutral until we had this governor, Gray Davis, get into office, who decided, probably looking into the future for his political future, that, gee, if we open up domestic partnership to heterosexuals, then they're going to accuse me of undermining marriage because we're giving people an option. So he twisted the arm of the author of the bill to force her to exclude heterosexual couples from the bill, and then he would sign it. So she did so reluctantly. She held her nose, but she did it. And then a couple of us, and I had some backing from a rich guy which helped, took out some ads in newspapers attacking this approach and saying how this was, you know, against seniors and so on, and we stirred senior groups up against the governor. So before long, he did a compromise, which was better than nothing, but still kind of weird. So the ultimate law said that same-sex couples of any adult age and seniors, if both parties were over the age of 62, if they were heterosexuals, could register and gain the benefits and protections. So that's how it started out. Eventually, they said only one of the people had to be over 62. So to this day, the domestic partnership law in California excludes the majority of domestic partners. And I get emails all the time from people around the country saying, this isn't fair. I mean, why should I have to get married in order to get equal benefits in the workplace if we choose to, we want domestic partnership, we don't want marriage. So I'm just thinking that you know, going back to the voters at some point to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, which isn't going to automatically legalize same-sex marriage. It just takes away the restriction. And then adding to it some authorization, which again is not going to mandate domestic partnership, but at least authorize those who want to do it to give the benefits to a broader class of people, makes it more palatable for the voters to do something like that. So, and then with respect to marriage and legalizing same-sex marriage, you know, in the state, I think the answer is going to come at the federal level primarily. It's going to come through Congress. Tomorrow, Representative Gerald Nadler from New York is introducing a bill to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level. I'm hoping that there are the votes to make that happen. I don't know if he's going to repeal, his bill would repeal both portions or only the portion that prohibits the federal government from extending benefits to people who are legally married under state law, or whether it will also repeal the other portion that authorizes the states to refuse to recognize a marriage that's validly performed. I hope he goes all the way. I mean, it would certainly simplify things. And if he goes all the way, then the argument that federal law specifically authorizes Michigan to refuse to recognize a marriage from out of state, you've got a better argument if somebody gets married and comes into Michigan and wants that marriage recognized, and there is no federal law authorizing it, and you just have your state Defense of Marriage Act, you've got a better shot at an argument in court.
I have a question. The APA Journal that just came out a couple days ago about Olson boys taking over the Prop 8 right in California, and how some of the same-sex advocates are having some issues with them taking it over because of the fact that you're taking it federal versus leaving it to state.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I like the notion of people who have been involved in the GLBT movement and thinking about it for years and planning strategically, state by state, doing this so that we don't upset the apple cart and we maximize our potential by building at the state level. But that's not life. People have the right to go to court on their own, and they have the right to do it on their own. And who are we to say, don't do it? I mean, we can tell them, but if they still insist on doing it, that's what happens in society. So now it turns out that the gay and lesbian rights groups wanted to decide, now we want in on the case. And the judge said no. They allowed the city of San Francisco to get into the case as a party to the case. But I think that there actually are some really good arguments at the federal level against Prop 8. And I think that one of the arguments, and I don't know if they've made this or not, but one of the arguments arises as a result of the Supreme Court grandmothering in the 18,000 couples, such as myself and my spouse, who married, you know, we married last, we did the thing on international waters, and then we did it again, you know, legally last year. My sister Carolyn was designated by the state to be our officiator, so she officiated, and all of that. So there, now we've got a situation in California where 18,000 same-sex couples are married, and other people who want to, same-sex couples who want to get married can't get married, and people from out of state who were married during that interim are recognized by the state of California, but those who married after are not. It's become an absolute equal protection nightmare. So how can it be that I can have equal rights, marriage rights, but my next door neighbor, because he tried to get married the day after the initiative came, I mean, we're similarly situated in everything else. So I think that there's that alone could create a federal equal protection problem. So, you know, there's a, and if that's the case, then, you know, then everyone in California would be able to, you know, and then there are other arguments for, under equal protection as well. But also I think the argument that the suit against the Federal Defense of Marriage Act by the state of Massachusetts and the couples in Massachusetts, that is going to be strengthened so much if Congress, you know, repeals the Defense of Marriage Act. I mean, maybe the case will even be dismissed as moot because everyone will, it'll all be recognized. So, you know, we're in an evolutionary phase where things are bubbling up so fast. It's, how can you control that? It was a miracle that they were able to control the progression of dominoes falling in the states, you know, the way they did. And choosing those states was very clever, you know, including Iowa, where it's not so easy to repeal. And now I saw in Iowa they're going to try and target three of the justices who are up for retention election next year. But that's three of seven. And it was a unanimous decision. So that's not going to change the result. So I think we've gone too far with that. The question comes down to Michigan. And in this particular case, what can people do in Michigan? And I think some cases it's creativity. It's getting the conversation going at the state level with something like, you know, a registry, family registry, and getting newspaper articles and protesting. I mean, why shouldn't we have a place to register? And then getting something on the ballot again, maybe in 2012 or whatever, and using between now and then to organize around it, but making sure that it's broad enough that it brings in more people than just same-sex marriage. And then looking, in some cases, working really hard at the federal level for federal protection, where that may be the only way you get your protection because of the stupid religious exemption that's been created by the Supreme Court. So it's, and maybe the, you know, while the governor's still in office, there may be some other things. Maybe she should appoint some more openly gay and lesbian judges. I mean, I know what happened, and more people who are open should be running for office in the legislature, even if they lose. The issues are raised, and if they win, it becomes much harder for the opposition to vilify us and to use, you know, derogatory terminology and so on. I listened to over the internet on live stream. I listened to each of the debates in each of the state houses in Vermont, in Maine, in New Hampshire, and so on. And because there were a number of openly gay and lesbian people in those bodies, even the opposition, the type of conversation was so respectful, the tone completely changed. And I know in California, so much of the success in the past few years for Safe Schools Act, for GLBT students, and a Comprehensive Domestic Partnership Act that is like same as Washington State's, like marriage and everything but name. A lot of laws passed because of rubbing shoulders with gays and lesbians in the legislature and getting to know them. And it's just so much harder when you're, oh, would you vote for my bill? But, you know, I want to like slam you and deny you your rights. You know, it doesn't work that way. So I think that that's the other thing here, is to encourage people to get involved in the political process and to really let the governor know just how important it is to appoint open people to positions during her remaining time in office, and not to be fearful of, you know, that they'll lose in a retention election when the family values people try to, you know, well, that may be so, but now is when we need your help, you know, and we need you to stick your neck out. And so what if Rudy Serra is appointed as a judge in Oakland County and some Republican candidate opposes him and wins because they try to slam him in Oakland County? It creates an opportunity for educating the public that we're not villains, we're good people. He's a great person. He's a fair-minded person. He's an intelligent person. He was a judge. You know, all of that. And if he loses, he loses. What have we lost? One local judge? I mean, is that really such a risk that the Democratic Party should, like, tell her not to do that? So I just think, but she needs to hear. And the Democratic Party needs to hear, because that's where it's coming from for these appointments. And then whenever somebody wants to stir up trouble with the family registry, just let me know and I'd be happy to brainstorm with you. So I think it's 20 after 1. Also, I have books here, but if you wanted to obtain a book, I remember it was hard financially for students. They sell for $20. $10 gets you a book. And that's like my cost. And so I've got these available here, and you can later get them on the website if you can't afford that now. But I think it's... And then there's also postcards here that if you want to share it with people, take some postcards, send it out, encourage people. We just need to keep people thinking creatively, remembering the past and the struggles that some of us have gone through, and then look at the situation people are in today and the struggles they're going through, and then just get creative and, you know, stir things up, and there's a better future. So that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.